Okay, this is the Shir on the Book of Yechezkel, Le'ilu Nishmos Ephraim Shmuel ben Avram Aryeh Cohen, and Chaya Tova Bas Eliezer Mendel Cohen. We are holding in Zechariah. We're losing people. There's people disappeared off the screen. I don't know why. We're holding in Zechariah in chapter 16, and we're up to verse 9. This chapter, or the first part of this chapter,
Excuse me, Yecheskel.
Yechezkel, chapter 16, verse 9. This chapter is basically, the first part of this chapter is a review of Jewish history. It's a review of God's contribution to the birth of the Jewish people. And eventually it'll run into a description of God's disappointment at the behavior of the Jewish people, as we'll see. But at this present time, as we're in verse 9, we've from verse 1 through to verse 8 so far, we've been discussing the fact that the Jewish people are allegorized as a baby, a lost baby, an abandoned child that God picks up and eventually decides he brings the child up, he nurtures the child, baby girl, and then he decides to marry this child. So here we're up to verse 9 at the point where the chuppah between the foundling, who's now reached adulthood, and the kind gentleman that brought this child up, is about to take place, the wedding ceremony. And of course, in the context of the allegory, the place of the chuppah, the place of the marriage ceremony, is of course Mount Sinai and the giving of the Torah. And so God says in verse 9, I washed you with water. I rinsed your blood from off of you. And I anointed you with oil. So as the Abravanel points out here, there seems to be a bit of a problem in the sequence of events of the marshal, of the parable, of the allegory here, because if you go back to verse 4, verse 4 tells us that when this generous man or God found the baby girl deserted in the field, the baby was described in verse 4 who, as ubamaim lo ruchutz, that you were not washed, lemishev amelech lo you were not washed, you were not salted, you were not swaddled in clothes. Now at that point, when God, so to speak, found the foundling, the Jewish people, there is no indication that this generous man, God, washed or swaddled or clothed the child. And in verse 6, again, the generous man who picked up this child, this baby girl, God, describing the baby girl, that he found, which is Israel, the Jewish people. He describes of Ivar, I passed by you and I saw you, how downtrodden you were in your own birth blood. And I said to you, in your blood you will live, in your blood you will live. Again, there, in verse 6, there's no attempt at this stage to wash the child or to swaddle the child or to clothe the child. And then in verse 7, describes the baby Israel growing to some type of maturity and puberty, as we discussed in the last year, where the verse said in verse 7, Shadaim nachonu usarech tzimeach, you grew up with shapely firm breasts and your pubic hair grew, but at Eram v'Eriyeh, but you were still naked and bare. Again, even as the baby Israel grew to adulthood and puberty, there is no sense that the baby Israel is washed or swaddled or clothed. She was still naked as the day she was born. And again, in verse 8, we see the fully grown baby, the fully grown Jewish people in adulthood as they're redeemed from Egypt. And the generous man that picks the child up, God, decides that he's fallen in love with the foundling and now wishes to marry her. And that was verse 8, which we did in the last year. V'hinei teich eis dodim, I fell in love with you. And I spread my cloak over you. and I covered up your nakedness. Va'eshvaloch, and I swore to you. Va'avav v'brisitoch, and I came into a covenant, into a promise with you. There's no expression there that God washed the child, but at least the child now is clothed to a certain extent. But no indication that the generous man, that God has yet washed the baby, washed Israel of the blood that was covering her when he first found her. It's only here in verse 9, which we've just read, that the baby, who's now reached a state of maturity, is cleaned up, as it says here in our verse. Ve'erchotzech b'mayim, I washed you with water, v'eshtov damayach me'alayach, and I rinsed your blood off of you. Ve'asuchech b'shomet, and I anointed you, I rubbed you up with oil. And the question that Babineau wants to know is why didn't this generous man, this righteous man who picked up this foundling child, God, who picked up the Jewish people, wash the baby, Israel, of the blood that he found her covered in immediately after seeing her lying naked in the field, covered in her own birth blood? In other words, why doesn't this verse come out after verse 4, or at the very least after verse 6? So the answer to this question is actually quite straightforward, because from the time that the generous man, that God, found this baby girl, Israel, up until now, he's acted like a father to her. And a father's love, as everybody knows here, all the fathers here, are there any ladies here? Mother's love as well, but a parent's love is, of course, as we know, is unconditional. And the father realizes that a baby, a youth, and even an adolescent will continually be covered in blood, not literally blood, but meaning that a child, whilst growing up, will make plenty of mistakes. And even when the father washes and cleans her by pointing out the mistakes she makes or he makes and reprimanding the child, the baby, the youth, and then eventually the adolescent and the young adult will continue to make mistakes and become covered in blood all over again, become covered in mistakes all over again. But that through those initial stages of development, the father doesn't really care, because he's prepared to forgive anything that his child does based on the fact that his love for her is unconditional. He lets her wallow in her blood. He lets her wallow in her mistake. He lets her wallow in her sins. But in verses 8 and 9, we see that the relationship is going to change. It's not the relationship of a father to a daughter. The relationship's now going to change from the relationship of a father and a daughter to the relationship of a husband and a wife. And the father figure that brought up this child from its day of birth has now fallen in love with the foundling, and he's now going to marry her. And as we know, when it comes to marriage, the rules have to change. There can be unconditional love, but there has to be a quid pro quo in a marriage. There doesn't have to be a quid pro quo in the relationship between a father and a daughter, because I've just been on holiday with my own daughter. And everybody knows, you know, a father will let his daughter get away with almost anything. So that's the reality. Once the relationship changes, once you're in a not a father-daughter relationship, the rules have to change, and there has to be a quid pro quo in any marriage. It can't be all one-way traffic, as it is in the relationship between a father and a child. It's very interesting that the Torah itself commands twice a child to respect and be in awe of their parents. It says it in the Ten Commandments, Kabed es avicha v'esimecha. You have to honor, Kabed es avicha v'esimecha. You have to honor your father and your mother. And on the obverse of that, it says, Pasuk, I can't remember the Pasuk. Memories stuck. But it says you should be in awe of your mother and your father. when it tells you you've got to honor your father and your mother, the father comes first, because it's a natural reaction to give honor to your mother rather than to your father. And so it says the father first. But when it comes to being in awe, you're normally more in awe of your father. So the Torah uses the language of mother first. But the Torah commands you to honor and be in awe of your parents. There's no command in the Torah for a parent to love his child. Not. The Torah doesn't say that for hafta es bonech, bonech av es bonosecha. The Torah doesn't command you to love your children, because that's something that you, it just comes absolutely natural to you. A child has to be commanded to honor his parents, but parents don't have to be commanded to love their child, because the nature of parenthood is that you, a parent loves their child unconditionally. But again, when it comes to marriage, the certain modes of behavior that were previously acceptable in a father-daughter relationship have got no place in marriage. There has to be a high degree of reciprocity, mutual respect, and the avoidance of any behavior that could threaten the marriage. At this point, here in verse 9, the fully grown foundling, the Jewish people, are entering into a new relationship with this generous man that picked them up from the gutter, from the floor of the field, lying helpless in their own blood. At this stage, the blood, the previous inconsistent, unpredictable behavior of the foundling has to be, of the Jewish people, has to be replaced with mature reciprocity in a state of wedlock, in a state of marriage. See, it's the precondition for a good marriage. There has to be reciprocity. And as the Abravanel points out, this verse is the introduction to the chuppah, to the marriage ceremony of the Jewish people and God. God being the husband and the Jewish people being the wife. And he says as follows. He says, Zochar kan kifi hamoshel ma she'asalo ba'esha lokho le'isha. God describes the process of the changing status of the foundling, Israel, from being a child in the care of a father figure into the status of being a married woman and the expectations that go with that. God says, so to speak, bathed her, bathed Israel in water. And he dipped her in a mikvah, as is the custom for new brides before coming to the chuppah, an allegory to the fact that after marriage, certain restrictions on behavior, especially sexual behavior, comes into force. And this foundling Israel was a nidda. She was stained. She was sullied from her experiences growing up in the pagan cauldron, or being born and having been umbilically connected originally as she was born to the pagan cauldron of Egypt. So God at Mount Sinai, the scene of the marriage, removes, eliminates from view all those mistakes, all those faults, all that blood, the blood of the past. God removes the sins, the blood, the mistakes of her youth to create a clean slate for the start of the marriage, a beautiful allegory. And God says, God anointed the bride with oil, the Jewish people with oil. Remez, Lamasha, Omer, Bamatan, Torah. It's a final preparation for the marriage ceremony. But Remez Lamasha Omer B'Matan Torah Leich El Ha'om B'Kidashtem Hayom U'Mocho B'Kipso Sibloso. After the cleansing in the mikveh, then removing the blood that covered her, overlooking all her past indiscretions, it was a time to anoint her skin, so that she was now ready to wear the wedding dress. As God tells Moshe at Sinai, "Bikidashtem hayam u'mocho, bikibso sibloso." Prepare them, sanctify them today and tomorrow, and then they will wear their freshly washed garments. So this language of being cleansed is a preparation for a marriage. The idea that it's a change in circumstances. God, so to speak, is prepared to forget any and all past indiscretions that have taken place up to this point, and they're entering into a new phase of a relationship, It's now no longer father-daughter. The relationship now is husband and wife. So at this point, she needs to be cleaned of, that's the idea, cleaned of all her blood, because God, so to speak, has come to the conclusion that, so to speak, all everything in the past is now forgotten. Everything that's taken place up to this
Mommy,
date is now forgotten.
Be gone for a whole week.
Sorry?
Playing the piano for Michael's wedding.
Sorry about that. I don't know what that was. Just a footnote here. Before we move on to verse 10, we get into the wedding itself on Mount Sinai. We learn a halacha from this verse. Very interesting halacha from this verse. It comes from the Sefer Chassidim and from Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Yehuda ben Shmuel HaChassid, from Regensburg, who lived in the 12th century, died in the year 1200. And he writes as follows. He says, "Ksiv." It writes in our pasuk, "Ve'erchatzech b'mayim ba'eshtav domayim," that God, so to speak, washed away or washed the Jewish people in water and removed all the blood and basically created a clean slate for the marriage that was to take place on Mount Sinai. So he writes, "Svicha tevila kodem suin, afal pi shelo ros adam." He says, from here we learn a halacha, which is a halacha lamaisa, that even if a girl who's getting married and she's getting married, but she's not nida, she's not menstruating or anything like that, she's not in the middle of a menstrual cycle and she's not tome or anything like that, nevertheless, she has to go to the mikveh before she gets married. Afal pi shelo ras adam, even though there's no blood, she's showing no blood, no blood discharge, she still has to go to the mikveh. This halacha we learn from this pasuk. The halacha is derabon, not deraisa. It's not a biblical requirement, it's a rabbinic requirement, but the halacha is it's been accepted as minhag Yisrael, minhag avosenu b'yodeinu, every bride goes to the mikveh before she gets married. And most men do as well. I don't know if any men here went to the mikveh on the day they got married. I didn't. Don't like the mikveh very much. I don't go to the mikveh. But some people go every day and some people go once a year. And Rav Soloveitchik used to say, what do you need a mikveh for? You got Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur's the mikveh. Women have to go to a mikveh because they become nida. But for men, the mikveh is Yom Kippur. You go in completely solid and you come out the other side clean and dry cleaned and, you know, ready for action. Absolutely spotless. So that's the mikveh. That's what Rob Soloveitchik used to say. Okay, now we move on to the Mount Sinai and Na'aseh B'Nishma in verse 10, verse Yud. Ve'el basheich rikma. God says, I clothe you with a beautiful rikma, which is embroidery and embroidered garments. Vanalech tochash. And I put shoes on you made out of the leather of a tachash, which is some type of animal. Ve'ech b'shach, ve'ech b'shach b'sheish, ve'achaseich meshi. And I wrapped you in linen and I covered you in silk. So exactly what does all this mean? So various opinions here, but we know this is the what happened on Mount Sinai when the Israelites said Na'aseh V'Nishma. Interestingly, the whole idea of Na'aseh V'Nishma has been written about for thousands of years, what it means. Why did the Jewish people say it before they'd even read the text? It's not normal to certainly for Jews to sign a contract before they've read the small print. But the Jewish people said Na'aseh V'Nishma. And the marriage ceremony, the chuppah between God and the Israelites was solemnized. Various wedding gifts were given to the Israelites by God on Mount Sinai. So here is you know, differences of opinion, but essentially it all boils down to the Torah and various aspects of not only gifts, but gifts that come with responsibilities. So God says here, Ba'el Basheich Rikma, I clothed you with beautifully embroidered garments. So So Rashi says the beautiful embroidered garments was the stuff you took from Egypt. The spoils and riches of Egypt that you took with you, also the spoils and riches that you would collect when you would later 40 years from now. At this point in time, it wasn't 40 years away, right? They were supposed to go straight to the land of Israel from Mount Sinai, but eventually it would be a 40-year journey. And when they'd conquer the land, they would take in all the spoils of the land. The exception to that would be the city of Jericho, the city of Jericho, where everything that was found in the city of Jericho was considered to be cherem. They weren't allowed to touch that, but virtually everything else that they conquered, everywhere else that they conquered, they it became a society that started off very affluent and got even more affluent. That's the opinion of Rashi. That's what it means, these embroidered garments. The Medrash, the Yalkut here in Yechezkel, the embroidered garments refers to the building of the Mishkan, which was beautified and covered with all these embroidered fabrics and also with tachash. It says here that the shoes were made out of tachash, which is the skin of some type of animal. So it refers to the Mishkan. And then it says, "Van en alech tochash," I put shoes on your feet, made of leather, made of tochash. Meaning, Rashi says, I put miraculous shoes on your feet. And this is like the rest of the attire that the Israelites had during their journey in the desert. Right? They didn't pass any convenience. They didn't pass any, a canyon on the way for 40 years. They had the same clothes that they left Egypt with. And the miraculous thing was about the journey the clothes they wore and the shoes that they wore never wore out. They never deteriorated and they never required cleaning. But they would wake up in the morning and their clothes would be clean and pressed and repaired so that they arrived in the land of Israel after their 40-year trek with the same outfits that they, I mean, probably out of date, right? Out of fashion, right? Flared trousers and all that. But everything was taken care of. And the shoes on their feet never wore out. And of course, we also find that with the children, as the children grew up, their clothes grew with them. So that's the idea of En Alech Tochash. Then the Pasuk says, Ve'ech B'sheich B'sheish, I wrapped you in linen. So Rashi says, God sanctified the Kohanim to serve the Jewish people, wearing turbans of fine linen, together with all the other big day kahuna, which also contained linen. The Ben Yoyada says, no, Ve'ech B'sheich B'sheish, I wrapped you in linen, doesn't refer to the big day kahuna, the clothes that the Kohanim wore, which were made out of linen, but it refers to tefillin, the reference being shin shin. Ve'ech b'sheish, ve'ech b'sheich, b'sheish. And the Ben Yoyada says the reference here, the word b'sheish refers to the two shins of the word sheish that represents the name Shaddai that appears on the tefillin. On both tefillin, one on the outside, one on the inside. So it says, Ve'ech b'sheish, ve'ech b'sheich, b'sheish. The shin shin stands for Shaddai Shaddai, which is the reference letter, the shin that appears on the tefillin. And on the inside of the tefillin, the clap says Shaddai, the name Shaddai. And then finally it says, Ve'achsech meshi, I covered you with silk. And again, Rashi quoting the Medrash. This refers to the silk, refers to the seven clouds of glory that accompanied the Jewish people through the desert, and is a play on the word meshi. As it says in Shemos, regarding the clouds of glory that accompanied the Jewish people through the desert, lo yomish. The pillars of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night were constant. They were a constant protection for the Jewish people. The pillar of cloud by day, which controlled the climate, and the pillar of fire by night, that gave them light and gave them heat and gave them protection, never disappeared. And it's introduced by the word lo yomish, which says the Medrash says yomish. This is the language of meshi. Meshi means silk, but it also comes from the language of lo yomish, that these clouds of glory that protected the Jews in the desert never disappeared. And again, the Ben Yehoyada, he says this also, this word meshi also refers to tefillin, is also a play on the word meshi, which can be refigured to produce the word shemi. Meshi, mem shin yud, you can change the letters around and you get the word shemi, my name, God's name, which is God's name is what appears on the tefillin. So various opinions about what these gifts were. But the Medrash Rabbah in B'Shalach, in Shemos, has got a combined interpretation of verses 9 and 10. The verse we read before, which was the approach to Mount Sinai, and verse 10 here, which is the actual ceremony on Mount Sinai. And the Medrash quotes a pasuk here from Shemos in chapter 13, which is Parshas B'Shalach, and quotes the pasuk. It says, by very, very interesting, very, very beautiful medrash here, that the medrash says as follows. Quotes this pasuk. It says, "Vayhi b'shalach paro es ha'om." It was when Pharaoh let the people go, eventually, v'lo nocham Elohim derech eretz pelishtim, that God did not lead them the quickest way out of Egypt, by way of the land of the Philistines, the Pelishtim, ki korofu, despite the fact that it was closer by, ki omar alehim, because God, so to speak, said to himself, or argued, or rationalized, pen yinochem ha'om birosa melchom avashov Mitzrayim, lest the people reconsider when they see war, like if they're going to be traveling through the land of the Philistines, so the Philistines aren't going to take kindly to that, they'll come out to war, and the Jews will say, what's this? We've just been released from prison and we're already, you know, being attacked. Let's run back to Egypt. So the Pasuk's a very strange Pasuk anyway, but nevertheless, the Pasuk says that that's why God took them the long way round, all the way down south, as far as the Reed Sea, or wherever that is. You can read the book on exactly where Mount Sinai is and where they crossed the Red Sea, various opinions on that. But the Medrash says that God did not lead them via the way of the land. And the Medrash splits up the Pasuk like this, which is an unusual reading of this verse. The Medrash says, you read the verse like this. Vayhi b'shalach paro es ha'om. It was when Pharaoh released the people, he let the people go, v'lo nocham alehim derech eretz, that God did not lead them with derech eretz. Now, the next word is plishtim. So really, the word plishtim should go into the sentence. It should read that God didn't lead them via the land of the plishtim. But the Medrash says, put a full stop after the word eretz. And then you get the words that God did not lead them by the way of the land. He did not lead them with derech eretz, meaning God did not conduct himself in the standard manner. Kederech kol ha'aretz. What is kederach kol ha'aretz? What does it mean to conduct yourself kederach kol ha'aretz with derech eretz? And the Medrash says, one who purchases slaves purchases them so they will bathe him, anoint him with oil, clothe him, transport him, and illuminate the way for him. But God did not do this with Israel. Rather, v'lo nocham Elohim derech eretz. God did not lead them in a standard manner, kederach kol ha'aretz. The journey out of Egypt, says the Medrash, was thus very unusual, and the reversal of the way a master normally interacts with a servant. God, the master, would bathe the Israelites, as we said in the previous verse, be'erchot sech b'mayim, that God bathed you in water. And God, the master, also anointed the Jews with oil. I anointed them with oil, which is in the previous verse. And here in verse 10, we heard that God the Master clothed them as well. I clothed you with embroidery. We also know from other sources, said the Medrash, that God the Master transported them chapter 19 of Shemos. I transported you on eagle's wings. Furthermore, God illuminated the way before them, as we discussed before, Vahashem Holech Lifnehem Yomon Ba'amud Anon Lanchosom HaDerech. God went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them on the way. V'layla Ba'amud Eish, and at night in a pillar of fire, Lahoir Lahem, to show them the way. And that's to say that what God is saying here, V'lo Nochom Elohim Derech Eretz, God did not lead them in the usual way, Derech Eretz, the normal way where a servant normally provides services to the master. Here, the master is providing the services to the servant, which is, we just signed on to be God's servant. Vayiru Ames Hashem, Ve'aminu Hashem, Uba Moshe Avdo. That they understood that, as well as being in a marriage contract with God, they were also, the expectation was that they'd emulate God. God would be the master to whom they would look to emulate. And the normal procedure is the master has everything done by his servants. The servants do everything for the master. But the lo nochom Elohim derech eretz, that's not what happened with the Jews and God. God did everything. God, the master, did everything for them. So the allegory, parable of the formative history of the Jewish people and their gifts started on Mount Sinai. So far we've got references to the very fact that God gave them the idea of the spoils and riches of their enemies, the Mishkan, which would come later, the fact that he looked after them in the desert, he made a contract with them that he looked after them in the desert, and clothed them and look after them and feed them, and their clothes would never deteriorate, etc., etc. And in verse 11, the gifts continue. Voidech edi ve'et not smidim al yodyech ve'rovid al gronech. And I adorned you with my jewelry, and I put two bracelets on your hands and a necklace around your neck. Now, exactly what this verse is talking about, the multiple ways of understanding this verse. What is the jewelry? What are the two bracelets? What is the necklace? What are these things? So we'll go through, there's like 12 different opinions about what's going on in this verse. I'll just give you the four most popular ones. Let's start with the jewelry. Voideich edi, I adorned you with my jewelry. So this is option one, meaning the gift. That's the Torah. That's the Torah. The God's jewelry is the Torah. Ve'nod smiudim al yodyech, and I put a pair of bracelets on your hands, meaning the Torah was given via two bracelets, alluding to the two luchos, the two tablets that Moshe brought down with him from Mount Sinai in his hands, each one having five of the Aseres Adibros inscribed upon them. And then the verse says, Barovid al gronech, and I put a necklace around your neck. The necklace around your neck is the gift of prophecy that all the Israelites at Mount Sinai were gifted with as God spoke to them. So that's those are the three gifts, according to the first opinion. The jewelry is the Torah. The bracelets were the Torah that was given via the two tablets of stone. And the necklace around your neck refers to the prophecy that they all felt. It gripped them from their neck upwards, that they actually felt, they actually experienced prophecy as God spoke to them. That's option one. Option two is the Malbim. Option one, by the way, is the majority opinion. Option two is the Malbim. Voideich edi, I adored you with jewelry, says the Malbim. That's the Torah. Yeah, agree. 613 mitzvahs. Ve'etnot smidim al yodyech, I put a pair of bracelets on your hands. This refers to the mitzvahs that a person can do with his hands. Mitzvahs that involve action. That's why they're on the hands. Barovid al gronech, and a necklace around your throat. This refers to the mitzvahs that a person can do with his voice. mitzvahs that involve talking. So you got all the mitzvahs there. So the jewelry itself refers to all the mitzvahs. And then it's split up into two types of mitzvahs. Mitzvahs that you can do via your hands, via action, and mitzvahs that you can do via your throat, via talking. And there is a huge difference in halachic terms between mitzvahs that involve action, a mitzvah yesh yesh bo maisa, and a mitzvah she'ein bo maisa, that mitzvahs that are done through action and mitzvahs that are done through verbalizing, davening, saying the Shema, speaking nicely, saying Kiddush, giving evidence, truthful evidence in court, etc., etc. These are the two types. In halacha, it makes a huge difference whether a mitzvah is a mitzvah sheyesh bo maisa or a mitzvah she'ein bo maisa, a mitzvah that involves some type of action, or a mitzvah that does not involve some type of action. We won't go into that now because that gets complicated. So that's option number two. That's the opinion of the Malbim. Option number three comes from a medrash in Shir HaShirim. Va'edech Edi, God says, I adorned you with jewelry. The jewelry refers to weaponry. And the medrash brings the opinion of Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, the weapon that was given to them at Horeb, the weapon that was given to the Jewish people on Mount Sinai, was how to use the ineffable name of God, the Yud, the He, the Vav, He, name of God, as a weapon, which they will use later, much later on, before they enter the land of Israel, most notably when they take on Og Melech HaBoshon. But they had they were given the power to be able to use the name of God, the Yud, He, Vav, He, name of God. Ve'ednod smidim al yodyech, I put a pair of bracelets on your hands, says the Medrash. These are the tablets of the Ten Commandments, which is something that was mentioned before, because it says in the Torah about the tablets, va'aluchos mas alehim heima, va'amichtov michtav alehim hu, chorus al aluchos. That the tablets were God's work, and the inscription was God's inscription engraved on the tablets. That's what it means. Yodech, it was something that God did, so to speak, with his hands. God engraved the tablets with his hands. That's what the Medrash says. And finally, Barovid al Gronech, God put a necklace around their necks. These are the letters of the words of the Torah. As it says in Mishle, Koshrim al Libcha Tomid, Indom al Garganosech, bind them, the words of the Torah, upon your heart, and tie them around your neck. These are the words of the Torah. So it says, Barovid here al Gronech, God put a necklace around your throat. These are the letters and the words of the Torah that you're supposed to be speaking every day. So those are three of the opinions. Finally, the strangest opinion of all, which I always like to bring, is the opinion of the Ben Ish Chai. And the Ben Ish Chai says as follows. He says, what are the three gifts here? He says, Vaydech Edi, the jewelry, Yuvan B'Shiata Dishmaik Yisrael, Simonim Rachamim, Gomle Chasodim. That one of the Simonim, one of the signs that you're a Jewish person, that people should know, to recognize a Jewish person, is that Jews are Rachmonim, they're merciful people, and gomle chasodim, they do kind deeds. V'zeh ha-Torah shel rachmonus v'chesed nishtabeach ha-bori yizborach, ki hu yizborach midoso el racham v'chanan v'rav chesed. He said it's well known that the attributes of the Jewish people are that they are merciful, who are always looking to do kindness, and these two attributes are also the signature of the Creator, which are described in the 13 attributes of God that we say, especially at the end of the year, beginning of the new year, in the days leading up to Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, the Aseret Yemei Teshuvah, the 10 days of penitence. We say God is El Racham B'Chanan, God is a God of compassion and grace, the Rab Chesed, and he's abounding in loving kindness. Says the Ben Ish Chai, Ulazeh Omer, and that's why the gift here, Vaydech Edi. That is the meaning of the words Vaydech Edi. God says, I adorned you with my jewelry. Edi, my jewelry. Meaning, Rotzaloma HaTorah, Vakishut Shali, Kaviyochol, Kishtaseich. Shagam Eschem Osisi Shetiyu Nikroim Rachmonim Vagom Lechasodim. Says God, I on Mount Sinai decorated you with these, with my attributes. I changed your DNA so that you would also be called throughout history a compassionate and merciful people who are abounding in loving kindness just like me. That's what it means by Deich Edi, Edi, my jewelry. God says, I gave you my jewelry, jewelry. I instilled in you my DNA. And anyone that knows anything about Jewish history will know that at any given point in Jewish history, the Jews are always the ones that step forward first to help. to name but a few, everybody who's American knows that the Jews were the first to come forward to help the blacks in the civil rights movement. The Jews were the first to come forward and help the blacks in the apartheid times. And Jews have always, throughout world history, have always been the ones at the forefront of doing chesed and rachamim. So this is the first gift. The first gift is that they will have God's DNA in them. God's DNA of racham v'chanan v'rav chesed. The second thing, ve'egnot smidim al yodyech. The Ravid al Gronech. God said, I put a pair of bracelets on your hands and a necklace around your neck. Says the Ben Ish Chai, Yuvan B'siyata Dishmai. It's known with the help of heaven, Ki Hatafilin Hu Os Li Yisrael Shehem Amo Yisborach. It's known that the Tefillin are the Os, they're the sign for Israel. There are a few things in Judaism that are called an Os, a sign. Shabbos is called an Os, Os Hili Olam, Kishesh Yomim Asa Hashem Asa Shemayim Asa Oretz, V'Yom Hashvi Shabbos V'Enochash, and Tefillin is also called an Os, which indicates that they are God's people, Goy Echad Ba'Oretz, they're a unique nation on earth. U'lezeh Oma, and that's why it says, V'etnot Smidim Al Yodyech. And that's the meaning where God says, I put a pair of bracelets on your hands. Remed le tefillin shel yad, lovshim oso techila. The first bracelet, so to speak, is hinting at the tefillin shel yad that is put on first. Veravid al gronech, which is a remed le tefillin shel rosh. And the necklace around your neck is a reference to the tefillin shel rosh. Sheyorodim haratzuah shelo al hagoron mikan mikan, an allusion to the tefillin shel rosh, whose straps come down from the head, passing the throat on either side of the neck. So these are the tzmidim, the bracelets, the tefillin shel yad, and the rovid al gronech, and the necklace around your neck, to indicate that you are goyachod boretz. Which the Gemara says in Brochus, and Davvav, that God wears tefillin, right? So that's hard enough for us to understand anyway. What's God doing wearing tefillin? So I won't go into that, exactly what that means, other than to say that from Kabbalistic terms, there's only one set of tefillin in creation, which is the pair that God wears. What we wear are a physical representation of what tefillin actually are. But nevertheless, the Gemara in Brocha says that God wears tefillin. So the Gemara asks, not unnaturally, well, we know what it says in the tefillin that we wear, it praises God, the Shema and praising of God, etc., etc. What does it say in God's tefillin? Like what in the parchment, in God's tefillin, Shel Rosh, what does it say? It can't say Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, because that's our gig, that's our apostle. So what does it say in God's tefillin shel rosh? So the Gemara says, it says, Goy echad ba'aretz, ato echad b'shimcha echad, that's what we say. You are unique, and your name is unique, and you say, Goy echad ba'aretz, something we say on Mincha and Shabbos, Goy echad ba'aretz, there's a unique nation on earth. That's what God, my nation is a unique nation on earth. So that is what God gave us on Mount Sinai, the three gifts according to the Ben Ish Chai. Obviously, I always favor the Ben Ish Chai. The three gifts he gave us are eternal gifts, the gifts of Racham Bechanun and Erech Apayim Rav Chesed, that we are inherently, genetically, good people, merciful people, kind people, and also we have the gift of tefillin, the gift of tefillin that we put on our arms, tzmidim, bracelets, and ravid al grunech, and the tefillin shorosh that we put on our heads. I'm not going to get into the discussion now about why women don't wear tefillin. That's a discussion for another time. It seems from the Gemara, anybody wants to do some investigation into that. So the place to look is in Kiddushin. I know that people, this is what takes up people's time now rather than learning Gemara, but they want to know where's the reference to women wear tefillin. So if you want to look in the Gemara in Kiddushin on Daf Lama Bom on basis, the Tois was there, the third Tois was down, discusses the appropriate, I don't think that's the word, appropriateness. What would be a better word than appropriateness? I don't know. Whether it would be appropriate for women to wear tefillin or not, whether to wear a talus or not. So Tosfos has got a long discussion there about whether it's appropriate. But certainly these are the gifts that were given to the Jewish people on Mount Sinai. And there's more gifts coming along in verse 12. Vayitein nezam al apech. God says, I put a ring on your nose. Vayigilim al oznayich. And I put earrings in your ears. Va'ateres tiferes baroshech. And I put a crown of glory on your head. Again, various ways to understand the gifts here that God is giving to Israel at the time of the chuppah. And remember, this is the chuppah, right? So it's part of the mitzvah. It's part of the kiddushin ceremony for the husband to give the wife a gift, right? Our normal procedure is that the husband puts a ring on the finger, that something that he owns, and it has to be worth a pruta. But the idea of giving a gift and creating a bond, creating a kinyan, God gives more gifts at the chuppah on Mount Sinai than we normally do. So he says, first of all, he says, Nezem al apech, I put a ring in your nose. So Rashi says, the Nezem, this refers to the Oren HaKodesh. Exactly why, it's not quite clear. Didn't get really to the bottom of Rashi there, but I don't know why the a ring in your nose should refer to the Oren HaKodesh. Maybe someone can help me out with that, look it up and see exactly why that should be. I don't know. The Medrash here, the ring in your nose, it's the original Sefer Torah. And he's got a proof from Shir HaShirim. In Shir HaShirim, Shlomo HaMelech says, Apech kemigdal halvono, your nose, which is the Torah, is our great pure tower. So it uses the word apech, your nose, when referring to the Torah, because the Torah has got the smell of God, so to speak, the idea of reach nichoach, that when you make an offering, it creates a good smell. Doesn't mean that God smells it and, you know, oh, that smells nice. That's a nice piece of roast beef there. No, it's a shmek that the Jewish people say. It's got a shmek of good. The Torah has got a smell of greatness to it. So apeich refers to the Torah. As the Medrash in Shir HaShirim says, the nose, the nezem here also refers to the tzitz. The tzitz is not tzitzis. The tzitz is worn by the Kohen Gadol on his forehead, above his ears. That was the catalyst for the atonement of sin. Now, this is one of the big day kahuna. The Torah describes it in Shemos. We've just had it in the last few weeks in chapter 39. By Yasu es tzitz nezer hakodesh. They made a tzitz, which was a holy nezer. And this is the language that God uses here, that God gave them nezem al apech. God put a nezem in their nose. And the same language is used in the Torah to describe the tzitz, which is put around the Kohen Gadol's head. It's made out of gold. Vayichtavu alav michtav petuchei chosom, and engraved upon it are the words Kodesh Lashem, holy to God. So that, take it or leave it. What does it mean? Nezer malapech. I put a ring in your nose. Either it's referring to the Oron HaKodesh, I don't know why that would be, or it's referring to the Sefer Torah, or it's referring to the Tzitz. No one really knows. Then the Pasuk says, God gave them an agilim al oznayich. I put earrings in your ears. So Rashi says this refers to the clouds of glory. They're called agilim because they encircled Ogul. They encircled the Jewish people in the desert for 40 years. They provided agilim. They provided a circular protection fence around the Jewish people. Again, the Medrash says this refers to the Ten Commandments, which were heard by everyone's ears. Agilim az olaznayich, earrings in your ears, something that you heard. But it's interesting that the Torah doesn't say that. The Torah doesn't say that they heard what God said, does it? What does it say? What does the Torah say about how they experienced the Ten Commandments? Does it say that they heard it? Anyone?
They saw it.
Ah, it says Veroi Mesakolos. They saw the sounds. So they didn't experience it through the ears, like this Medrash seems to imply. The Torah actually says they experienced as a visual message, rather than a oral message that they heard. They saw it. How that works, that's another shir. How can you see sound? So we know you can see sound. We can reproduce it in, if anyone's used a CRO in physics, a cathode ray oscilloscope, you can see sound. But I don't know if that's what it means. Another opinion here, then Yechezkel says, Ba'ateres tiferes baroshech, God put a crown of glory on their heads. And again, Rashi says, the crown of glory on their heads, this is the angel that traveled in front of them in the desert, the angel Metatron that traveled in front of them in the desert. Exactly what that refers to, I'm not really sure. The Medrash here says it refers to God's presence that accompanied them in the desert. And that's something that Micha points out, the prophet Micha in chapter 2 of his Sefer. He says as follows, this is chapter 2, verse 13 of the book of Micha. Micha says as follows, Allah haporeitz lifneihem, the Savior goes before them, Portsu vayavru, they broke and they passed through Shar, through the gate, Vayotsubo, and they went through it, Vayavo Malcolm Lifnehem, and their king passed before them, Vahashem Barosha, and God was at their head. Micha there in chapter 2 is discussing the exodus from Egypt and the journey through the desert, and he finishes off the passage by Hashem Barosha, that God was on their heads, so literally on their heads, but meaning led them. And that's what it means, says the Medrash, Ba'ateres Tiferes Baroshech, that God was their crowning glory on their head, not literally on their head, but in front of them, led them. So that's the gifts. And, more gifts. And in verse 13, coming to the end of the gifts. Maybe we should stop here. I will just say over verse 13, Va'atadi zohar v'chesev, v'chesev, this is talking about the bride, about the Jewish people, what they did for themselves. These are what the Jewish people treated themselves to, so to speak. All these previous verses are gifts from God that God gave to his bride, the Jewish people on Mount Sinai, which included everything, really. If you take into account all the opinions, the Torah, the mitzvah of tefillin, the clothes they wore, the food, everything that they were going to need for the next 40 years in the desert, and also the ability to conquer the land of Israel, all the mitzvahs and everything else, those were the gifts that God gave to them on Mount Sinai. And in verse 13, the prophet describes what the Jewish people adorned themselves, like the gifts they gave themselves. But Tadizov Ochetzer, God says, and you adorned yourself with gold and silver, Umal Bushech Sheish Bameshi Barikmo, and your clothing was fine linen, silk, and embroidered clothes, Soles Udavash Vashemen Ocholt, fine flour, honey, and oil you ate, Batipi Bimod Maod, and you became very beautiful, Batitzlachi Limalucha, and you became fit for the throne. So these were all the additions. Apart from all the gifts that God gave them on Mount Sinai, continually along the way, they found things that God had left for them. And as we'll see, what Zohar v'Chesev, what does it mean that they adorn themselves with gold and silver, and the different types of clothes that are described here, and the different types of food, Soles u'Davash v'Shemen, fine flour, honey, and oil, and that the Jewish people became very beautiful, and Vatitzlachi Lemlucha, and you became fit for the throne. So this now starts the period, the transformation of the Israelites from the desert nomads to the conquerors of Israel, and their consolidation of power in the region, the Middle East, thanks to God, the gift of the husband on Mount Sinai. So basically what the prophet is doing is he's missing out the 40-year journey in the desert. We're going straight from the period on Mount Sinai, the gifts they received on Mount Sinai. And in verse 13, we come to like a segue to the point where they came into the land, or what they ate during their desert experience, a brief resume of their desert experience, and then Vatitzlach in the same verse, the last words, Vatitzlachi Lemelucha, you became fit for the throne. In other words, you became the conquerors, you became the rulers of the land, you became the rulers of the land of Israel. So that's where we'll pick up. We're just coming to the end of this section, where God describes up to verse 14. We're up to verse 13, but up to verse 14, God's describing everything, when everything was going well. The exodus from Egypt, the receiving of the Torah on Mount Sinai, the tricky 40-year journey through the desert where God provided everything for them, the conquest of the land of Israel, and up to that point, everything was going well. And that will take us through verses 13 and 14. It's after that, it's from that point onwards, from verse 15 onwards, that things start to go awry, that things start to go downhill, and the Jewish people start to lose their way. Once they've been given control of the land, and they're living in affluence, and they've got control, and they've got an indestructible army, and they've spread out over the land, and all the nations around them are afraid of them, it's at that point that the Jewish people start to go astray. And that will be when we get to verse 15. But the final two verses here, verses 13 and 14, will take us through to the point where they've conquered the land. And really, at that point, everything should be going well, because the relationship between husband and wife, between God and Jewish people, it will have had its few ups and downs in the desert. They'll be complaining about the water. They'll be complaining about the food. They'll be complaining. But essentially, they get to the point, they'll make too many complaints about the land with these spies, but eventually the game is complete. The project is complete. They enter the land of Israel and they conquer it, and they divide it up among the tribes, and they rule the Middle East, and they get to the point where they are in control of their own destiny. And it's at that point, as I said, when we get to verse 15, that things start to go downhill. So that's where we're at now. The marriage ceremony has taken place. They're about to travel through the desert, which will be dealt with in just one half a verse. And then they'll conquer the land. And then that's when the marriage starts to hit the rocks. So that's where we'll pick up next week in verse 13. And we'll
Harry,
continue. Yeah.
Quick word. Isn't all this jewelry more like an Adonia? Rather, very similar to Eliezer giving Rachel the jewelry and should we go?
Yeah, but there's no quid pro quo there. There's a quid pro quo here. The quid pro quo here was Nasa Venishma. If you notice, there's no gifts given until the Nasa Venishma. If you look at the Torah, there's no, God gives them nothing until they say Nasa Venishma, right? So, there's, yes, I do. What was it? I do. You have to say I do. It's a Christian thing, but, there has to be, the woman's got to, you know, it's got to be, consensual. It's got to be a consensual.
Rachel did say, I will. Isn't this like going back to the very beginning of
No, I don't think so, because if you remember, we talk about Rivka, yeah?
Rachel. No, Rivka.
Rivka, you talk about Rivka.
Yeah.
So you're talking about Rivka. So Rivka had to ask permission of her brothers and her father.
Uh-huh.
So there's a slight difference. She had to have permission from her brothers and her father. They were quite good about it. They said to her, well, what do you want to do? So she said, oh, yeah, I want to go. But really, the decision was with the father and the brothers, not with her. So it's slightly different. I mean, I understand there's a similarity in the sense of the idea, the description of the jewelry, etc. But essentially, the Jewish people here were required to make, you know, it's a quid pro quo here. The quid pro quo is Nasa V'nishma. That initiated the gifts. Yeah, go on.
Please, for next time or sometime in the future, can you draw us a comparison between a normal marriage and the marriage of the Jewish people to Hashem? Why should there always be a problem with Hashem when it's not the ideal marriage? I don't understand that.
I don't understand what your question is.
Normally, when a man and woman get married, they agree also. Everything is similar. The analogy is to a marriage.
Yeah.
Right? So here we have, we make an arrangement with Hashem. We're bride and groom. That's the story. And then in this particular prophecy, we depart. We drift away. Is there an analogy to a normal relationship? It's not a normal relationship.
Well,
it's an abnormal.
Well, excuse me. Statistics, the 21st century statistics would not agree with you, because nearly 50% or over 50% of marriages end in divorce.
Many of us are married to God.
Yeah, well, even so, you can still reject God, as we're going to see the Jewish people did on many occasions. It's just that God wouldn't give them a get.
Understand
it's
my
just
question.
I understand.
It should be
question.
A perfect marriage.
It should be, but it depends on, this takes two to tango. It takes two to tango, obviously. Now, God's not going to change his mind, and God's not going to give us a get, right? But the reality is...
So you're a mathematician. You have one constant, that's God. God doesn't change. We're always changing. Why?
Why? Because that's how we were created. We're created with free will.
No, but it's stupid.
Of course it's stupid, but that's the nature of free will. The nature of free will is you're going to make stupid choices. Every human being does it. To ask the question why, it's like, you know, how high is up? It's the nature of the human being is created in such a way that he's going to make mistakes. The whole essence of the creation is God created a perfectly imperfect world, including the creation of the human being. We're perfectly imperfect in the sense that we've got the ability to attain perfection, but we have to attain that perfection through our imperfections. The project would be irrelevant if we were perfect to start off with. If we were perfect beings, there'd be no purpose to the creation. The whole idea of the creation is for an imperfect being to try and perfect himself using his free will. Now, if you use your free will inappropriately, you're going to make bad choices. And if you make bad choices in a marriage, it'll generally lead to a divorce. The problem is, that when it comes to the marriage of God and the Jewish people, God's very clear about it. But erastichli li'olam, there is no divorce. We say it every morning when you put your tefillin on. But erastichli li'olam, God made it very clear on Mount Sinai that this is a marriage that can't be dissolved. There's no divorce here, right? And however bad the relationship gets, there's no divorce. God's not going to swap us for somebody else, as the Christians believe. That's just not going to happen.
Clearly, I'm not a genius, and I don't mean to prolong this, but I think it's a very important subject as to why are the Jewish people so stupid?
Well, I don't think the question specifically applies to the Jewish people. I think human beings. The Gemara in Sota says, this is the Gemara we're going to do in the morning, or on Wednesday morning. The Gemara says that a person's incapable of doing anything wrong unless the Ruach Shtus Bob Emsa, a spirit of stupidity enters him. You won't make a mistake unless the spirit of stupidity enters you. And that's the nature, but that's how it is. Human beings are like that. Life's like that. People make mistakes. People act foolishly. People act on instinct. People act on aggression. People lose their temper. People have got pride. People are seeking honor. People are narcissistic. And people have got egos. And that's just the nature of what human beings are. So the essence of what we are is try to be more godlike. Anyway, we have to suspend this discussion because it's getting late. But I don't know how to say it any better than I've said it. Human beings are capable of making mistakes. That is what defines them. The beauty about the human being and his ability to make mistakes is he's got the ability to correct them, to recognize the mistake, and through his own free will and his own intellect and his own bina and his own das, his own experience, to recognize he's made a mistake, and if he's put in the same position a second time, he won't make that mistake. And at that point, he's improved, and he's gone up one notch. He's moved up the ladder, getting closer to God, being more godlike, so to speak. Anyway, we'll leave it there, and we'll pick it up. Please, God, we'll pick up in verse 13 next week. Please, God. Hope everyone enjoyed the shiur. It's good to be back, and I'll see you all next week, same time, same place. In health and happiness, call to everybody.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you later, Ari.
Yeah.